Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say you liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. It all began with a single movie theater in Ripon, Wisconsin. But over the past 90 years, the Marcus Corporation has grown, joining the New York Stock Exchange back in the 90s, and also becoming the nationwide leader in entertainment and lodging. Joining us is the CEO of Marcus Corporation, Greg Marcus. And first of all, Greg, congratulations on 90 years.
Well, thank you for that, Olivia. It's good to be here 90 years.
Well, you
not me.
I was going to say, you haven't been here all 90 years.
No, I have not. My dad has.
Well, let's talk about your grandfather, because that was Ben Marcus.
Yeah.
And he was born where, in Poland?
He was born in a village in Poland called Stolps. It would have been around 1910. And he was one of five kids. He had four sisters. And the family immigrated when he was about 13 years old. And they came to America. And that's a whole story in and of itself. But they came across on a ship called the Berengaria. That's actually, we named our first real estate business a number of years ago here. We've subsequently changed the name because it's sort of a long, hard name. But we wanted to pay homage to it. And we try to remember our history. I think we're a company that says, let's remember our history. It's important. And we try to find places where we can do that.
How did your grandfather decide he wanted to open a movie theater? And what year was that?
He was 24, so it would have been 1935. I don't have to think that hard. We're 90 years old. Yes, I can do basic math. He started because, well, you have to go back a little bit further. When he came over, he went to Minneapolis. So what would happen is you'd come across, and then you would get settled around the United States, depending on where you had family, where you had some sort of connection. And he had family in Minneapolis. And so he went there, and he started to work for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. He had a paper route, but he had a crazy paper route. One thing he learned really early on was he could recruit people and delegate. He was very good at that. And so he had this giant paper route that got divided by four people when he finally gave it up. So he's a teenager, and he's got this great paper route. He's making some money. He ultimately starts to go to college, but he doesn't have enough money to finish college, and he's working for the Star Tribune still. He's now selling advertising. He's selling advertising to, among others, movie theaters, and he's helping them put together their ad copy. You know, because back in the day, you were putting together ads for a newspaper, a little different than today. And he thought, this is a really interesting business. He liked it, and he thought he could do it. So he started looking for locations, started looking around Minneapolis, actually. But he couldn't find a location around Minneapolis. It had been built out, and he just sort of widened his circle, and eventually he found a site in a city that he thought needed a theater, a town called Ripon, Wisconsin. And he bought a department store. It was a closed department store. He had saved up some money of his own. He had some family money other family members who'd saved some money. There wasn't family money at the time. Nobody had any money. But they'd been saving up, and he was very bright. Everybody always knew he was bright. He was always, as my dad said, if intellect was an Olympic sport, he won a gold medal every year. I mean, he just was a smart guy. So they knew and they trusted him with their money. And he started with this one theater, and he started to grow the theater business from there.
Do you know what attracted him to the theater business to begin with?
I don't think he liked to get up early. No, I might ask him, because we are a family of night owls. My dad can call me at 11 o'clock at night, and I'll answer the phone. And I said to him, I called him Papa, because he was my grandfather. And I said, Papa, why did you choose to get into the movie theater business? And he said, well, I didn't like to get up in the morning, which was not totally true, because he got up and he got moving and he had a lot on his plate. But I think he just thought it was fun, and he liked it, and he liked the hospitality side of the business, and he thought he could make some money with it.
I mean, and back in the mid-30s, that was the form of entertainment.
Yes.
Movies were king.
Yes. But television came along shortly thereafter.
Okay, but let's go back to the theaters, because that is where he really began to expand the business, because one theater didn't seem to be enough.
Yeah, he knew that. It goes back to this whole idea of, let's think about the newspapers, where he understood that if he could hire other people to take a piece of that, he could help coordinate the whole thing, and then there'd be something for him and for them. And I think he just sort of thought the same thing with his movie theater business. He could find other locations. He was very good at picking good real estate. So he would find a good location, and then he would hire people to run it for him. And so they all were able to make a living, and he was able to enjoy that as well.
How did your grandfather end up in Milwaukee?
Well, my grandmother really was probably the impetus for that. Her family was also actually from the same small town in Poland. Fun fact, her name was Seal Marcus when she met my grandfather. So she was Seal Marcus Marcus. For years, we tried to figure out how they were somehow related. There were a lot of Marcuses running around Poland, I guess, back in the early 1900s from other sides of the same family. But she was born in Minneapolis. She was a big city girl. So when he said, we're moving to Ripon, I don't think she was like, oh, that sounds like a great, I can't wait to move to Ripon. But now it turned out to be a great life for them. It was a great place to raise my dad. My dad had just been born. He was born 1935, along with the company, maybe just a little before the company. But I think she was sort of yearning to get back to a larger city. And they sort of worked their way up. They started in Ripon, and then they moved to Oshkosh. And then my dad was in high school at Oshkosh. And then my dad graduated. They moved down to Milwaukee.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
They said, Ben, the Pfister is not paying its bills. We're seeing there's something wrong there. And you're in the hotel business. You should buy the Pfister.
Greg Marcus talks about his grandfather's decision to expand from movie theaters and restaurants into hotels.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with Greg Marcus, the CEO of the Marcus Corporation. What was the plan? Once they moved to Milwaukee, did your grandfather want to stay in the movie business or did he want to expand in other areas?
Well, by then they were in other businesses because they had gone through the introduction of television and that was devastating to the movie theater business. My grandfather learned two things when that happened. One was that there will be an overreaction. The movie business wasn't going to go away. Was it going to change? Yeah, it was going to change. It wasn't going to be what it was. And it was hard for the business. I mean, it wasn't great financially for him. He never had a lot of debt. And by the way, these are all things that are still true to this day and what has gotten us through what we've gotten through today in the last, 5 years of the pandemic where we saw things that he never could have imagined. But he knew that people would overreact. These theaters were not exactly multi-purpose facilities. So he could go out and find people who own theaters and say, look, I can help you make your theater business. I can help you with this building that you've got. You know, your last guy blew out. He's got a lease with you. He had too much leverage on his building. And so now I can help you, Mr. Owner of this theater. I can run it for you. I know what we're doing. So he was able to grow the business by going and doing that and partnering up with people around Wisconsin and saying, I can help you grow your theater business. But he also said, you know what? I shouldn't just have all my eggs in one basket, given what just happened. And he started to make other investments. He was making real estate investments. He had seen Disney open Disneyland. And he thought, you know, they should have one of these in Florida. They didn't have Disney World yet. And he went with a guy that he knew. I guess they picked up some land in Florida. And he went out to meet with the Disney people because they knew Disney because of being in the theater business and said, you know, you've got this thing that's really doing great in California. You should do this in Florida. Now, they probably at this point had optioned up half of Orlando at this point and didn't tell them that. But they said the timing is not right. And my grandfather was okay. Well, but while he was in California, he saw this thing called Bob's Big Boy. And the guy he had partnered on the land with had also been in the restaurant business and said, you know, we should check out this Bob's Big Boy. It's supposedly going great. And it was. And so they actually, while they were there, decided they should get in that business and bought up the rights, started in Wisconsin. We ended up with the rights for four states in Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota over time and owned close to 70 Big Boys at one time. And so that part of the business has started to grow. So he had the theaters, he had restaurants, he had real estate investments, and that's when he moves to Milwaukee. So it wasn't when he got here that he decided to do something else.
The thing that I find interesting is it was 70 restaurants.
At one time, there were 110 restaurants. Okay. That was just Big Boys.
And how many theaters?
At that point, I don't have a clue.
Okay, so obviously dozens, tens of dozens. So he had all of these businesses plus his real estate interest. Why then did he decide to move on and say, you know what, I think maybe I want to go into lodging?
Well, he was in the lodging business, but in a way, this is a very funny story. So you're asking how did we end up with the Pfister probably is what you want to get
We'll
at.
Get to that.
Okay. Well, so you know, as part of his real estate investments, he owned some hotels. He owned a hotel in Appleton. It was called the Guest House Inn. And this hotel, to understand the rest of the story, to understand this hotel, it was a motor lodge. You think about what motor lodges used to be. I described this one as a Soprano, where you could pull up the car to the room, back it up, open the trunk, pull the body out, throw it in the trunk, and leave. I mean, that was not exactly the most sophisticated lodging operation. But it was, you know, I'm sure he was doing well with it because he did well with everything. But so now, fast forward, he's now in Milwaukee. He's got his businesses. He's got his restaurant business that's growing in use of the theaters. He's got other real estate. He's hanging out with his friends. His friends, probably a lot of people who had immigrated and who were immigrant families and who had been entrepreneurial because that's what they could do. So one of them is probably the meat purveyor to the Pfister. One of them is doing the dry cleaning for the Pfister. And they said to him, this was now early 60s, they said, Ben, the Pfister is not paying its bills. We're seeing there's something wrong there. And you're in the hotel business. This Soprano-style motel, which they, I mean, they didn't know what it was. They just knew. Who knows what he told them? He had a hotel in Appleton, right? They said, you're in the hotel business. You should buy the Pfister. And he's like, okay. I mean, the guy had guts and he was entrepreneurial and he was like, okay, why not? So what he did was he ultimately bought the loan because it was in financial distress. He bought the second mortgage, I guess, and ultimately he had to get a bunch of investors together because he didn't have enough money himself. And the Cole family was a part of it. And I think Max Carl, who was the guy who invented MGIC, who invented basically mortgage insurance, he's on this entrepreneurial people who were around Milwaukee and they were investors in the Pfister. And he put the deal together and they converted that loan to equity.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
This vibrant area of Milwaukee that's really been building over the last, you know, 30, 40 years, it was not that way 60 years ago.
Greg Marcus reveals the risks his family took by buying the Pfister Hotel.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Greg Marcus, the CEO of the Marcus Corporation. What was that condition of that hotel at that time, considering they had a lot of financial problems, hadn't been run well? It was probably...
Well, I was minus two at that point, so yeah. I couldn't tell you yet. I was not born. I'm not sure exactly. Well, I could tell you that I...
Was it a little bit of a risk, though?
Oh, it was a huge risk. Not so much what was going on with the hotel. Downtown. Downtown in the 60s was not the place to be. You have to think about it. The 50s was the move to suburbia, you know, the creation of the interstate system and the ability for people to commute in from the suburbs. So downtowns, especially in the Midwest, you'd seen the industry was leaving and downtowns are being hollowed out. The reason the Pfister was in financial distress is because of what was going on with the dynamics of downtown. What we know is downtown Milwaukee today, this vibrant area of Milwaukee that's really been building over the last, you know, 30, 40 years, it was not that way 60 years ago. And so, yeah, it was very risky. And then on top of that, you know, what you and I see as the Pfister today was not what we call the original building. They bought the original building that was built in 1893. That original building is what's on Wisconsin and Jefferson and sort of is bordered by that alley. And it went to mid-block. They got the whole block with it. And so they then built what is the tower.
Well, I know you said you were only 2 years old at the time.
No, I was minus two.
You weren't even born.
They bought it in 62. I was only minus two at that point.
But what was the vision? What was it that your grandfather had in mind when he bought this storied building? I mean, it had been around since the 1890s. Obviously, it must have been old and needed some work. What did he want to do with it?
Well, I think he had a few things. First of all, he understood, as I said before, he had a great sense of real estate, what would make a good location, what would make a good buy. I mean, all of our businesses, even to this day, really are based on real estate and understanding good real estate. I wish I could say we always made great real estate decisions, but we've made some pretty good ones through the years. He understood good real estate. He understood value. I don't even know what he paid for that note, but whatever he paid for it, the gutsy play was probably not buying the Pfister. The gutsy play was building the tower. That was probably the real gutsy part because you had no idea how that was going to do. And it was a very significant investment at the time. And this is exactly the time my dad comes back and joins the company. When they bought the Pfister, my dad came back. And then my dad really led the construction of the tower. But that was the guts play.
How involved was he in the actual construction? I mean, did he just turn it over to architects and say, you could do it? Or was
Ooh,
you're there...
talking about my dad or my grandfather?
Both of them. I mean,
oh,
how,
I'm sure they were,
how hands-on was it?
I don't know, but I'm sure they were very hands-on. If you know them, they were hands-on. My dad is a closet architect. He probably helped draw half of it.
As the Pfister became more of an institution here in Milwaukee, obviously it had been here. Am I correct? It's got the largest collection of Victorian art of any hotel in the world.
Yeah. And by the way, it's another point you make that it's important to say that my grandfather, not only did he realize value, and he said he realized if he could make the Pfister, owning the Pfister would be an important asset to own if he could make it work. Doesn't do any good if you go broke. I did say to my dad one time, right after we had bought the Grand Geneva in Lake Geneva, I was at that point part of the company, and I'm a golf nut, and we were walking down the 18th fairway of the Brute after we had just bought it. And I said to him, you know, if this thing makes money, this is the best thing we ever bought. If it doesn't, we should have gone on a nice vacation somewhere.
But what is it about the lodging industry and having what I would say are certainly luxurious hotels? What draws you to that? And what's the responsibility of a corporation when you have locations such as those?
Well, I mean, I think they're fun assets. As I said, this is a great fun. They're fun to own. They're complex. They're the oddity in our company's history in a little bit, because you know, we were sort of built on repeatable restaurants, repeatable hotels, and that my dad really was the guy behind Budgetel, ultimately Baymont, which were, there were 200 of them, but they were small and repeatable. Theaters are really, even though the boxes are big, there tend to be small businesses in a bigger box, but relatively repeatable assets. Hotels are not remotely repeatable. They are every one of them is different. And so, you know, there's something fun about the complexity of doing that and the challenge of doing that. I do think you have a responsibility if you're going to own an asset like that. You have to keep it up. You have to keep reinvesting in it. You can't just milk it. We've always been known as a company that comes to town, and we don't just come in and milk an asset and get rid of it and sell it and strip it for its value. We come in and we invest and we stay here and we give back to the community and we take care of the asset. And it becomes a virtuous cycle. It's productive. It's productive for us. It's a way we can make good investments and make a living and returns for our investors. And also at the same time, these are important assets for cities. And so to take care of them and to provide places for people to raise money. How much money has the Pfister made for charities? Think about how important it is for charities who hold their galas there, who have events there along the way, who are out trying to raise money. And I argue that the Pfister, actually, you can raise more money if you do your event at the Pfister than if you do it somewhere else because of the prestige of the Pfister. So it's sort of double win. Not only are we there just generally helping charities raise money, we actually help them make more money for themselves. Or, you know, think about if you're recruiting somebody to come work here. Where do you want them to stay? You know, you want them to stay at the Pfister. So they come here and they say, yeah, Milwaukee is a town with, this is a great town. And so it's important for other companies to be able to have this asset here to be able to take advantage of it. We do our part and we give back, and it's not altruistic. I mean, we do it because we make a living doing it. But at the same time, who do you take the most for granted? Your family, right? who's around? Well, sometimes I think we get a little taken for granted. We're just here. It's, of course we're here. It's a constant. And when I see things like this idea of building a new hotel downtown, and we're saying, could we get the hotel market healthy first? And people are like, well, you're just biased. I'm like, really? Have we not proven ourselves? Have we not been here for 60 some odd years? I mean, come on. We want what's best for the community. What's best for the community really is best for us too. And so it can be a little frustrating.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
I'm like, how is the coolest person that I know hugging the most uncool person that I know right now? How could this be happening?
Greg Marcus talks about a celebrity encounter at the Pfister.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is Greg Marcus. We're talking about the 90th anniversary of the Marcus Corporation. It seems that the Pfister is the place to be. If you're coming to Milwaukee, you want to stay. It's just the premium place. You come to
the
Pfister.
Well, I would say the St. Kate, too. So I'm gonna pick all my children.
And
it serves a purpose, too. But I would say that I always say that the Pfister is the Mercedes S-Class and the St. Kate is the Tesla.
Have you ever sat down and said, these are all the famous people who have stayed at the Pfister?
I don't know if we've cataloged it. There's so many. There's so many.
Have you ever run into any of them while you've just been at the Pfister?
Well, there's a great story, actually, that I always tell. So Al Jarreau would say that the Pfister was one of his first jobs, first paying gigs, and that he would say that the Pfister was the first brick on his yellow brick road, which is actually appropriate now because it's absolutely just crushing it in the movie theaters right now. So to talk about the yellow brick road is probably perfect. The person who gave him that job was my dad. And I didn't know this when I was a kid, that Al and my dad had this relationship and were friends. I mean, they weren't hanging out together a lot, but Al really had fondness for my father because he gave him one of his first paying gigs. So now fast forward 16 years. Al's doing great. He's a national success. I come into the Pfister with my dad one day because, you know, I'm hanging out with him. But let's just say that at 16 years old, you know, my dad is probably the most uncool person that I know. And I'm into jazz and that kind of music even back then, and popular music, and Al was jazz and popular. And we walk into the Pfister, and I'm probably trying to stay away from my father. And coming down the stairs in between the lions on those beautiful marbles, that marble staircase into the lobby, I look at him and think, that's Al Jarreau walking down the stairs. And the next thing I know, he looks at my dad and he's, Steve! And my dad looks at him, Al! And they hug. I'm like, how is the coolest person that I know hugging the most uncool person that I know right now? How could this be happening? What is going on? Eventually, I learned the story. We've got lots of stories about guests who've stayed there and famous people. We've had presidents there. I mean, just the whole...
How many presidents have stayed at the Pfister?
Oh, my God. I don't even know. Almost every single one of them. I think Obama didn't stay there. He's been there. They had events. But as they started to be able to travel more easily, they didn't stay as much. But I think almost every single one of them in the last 100 years has stayed there.
I know this is going to be just sort of a trite question, but there's always been that legend, the Pfister Hotel is haunted. Now, have you personally ever experienced anything there?
Well, let me just tell you it's haunted. But no, I've never. I never have. But it always makes for a good story. And we seem to get press about it. And they, as they say, there's no bad press. So
with all the people who have stayed there through the years, though, are there any in particular that you were personally impressed that this person stayed in our hotel?
Well, I thought it was pretty cool when the Rolling Stones stayed there. You know, that was actually.
Did they tear up the room?
No, they didn't. They were older, I guess. And I didn't actually meet them. I don't go there and meet them. I don't go do that stuff. But I thought it was pretty cool. Actually, what was really interesting is they weren't even playing in Milwaukee. They were playing in Madison and Chicago, and they loved the Pfister, and so they wanted to stay there. And they said, we'll just plant ourselves in between the two and stayed at the Pfister for like a week. And there's some legendary stories of them being there. I'm not jaded. I'm actually always impressed. Oh, that's cool. So-and-so is staying there. I mean, I always want to know, are they staying there? Did we get them? If we didn't get them, why? Why is so-and-so not staying at the Pfister? What's going on? How did they end up in the wrong hotel?
Well, you probably,
unless they're at the St. Kate, in which case I'm like, yeah, that's cool. Okay. Well,
that probably goes back to, why didn't the Beatles stay at the Pfister?
I don't even know.
Maybe they couldn't afford it?
Maybe. But Paul McCartney stayed there, so the Beatles have technically sort of Beatle have stayed. I'm sure other ones have stayed there through the years, too.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
You know, originally we had one theater, but then someone said, you know, you could show two movies at the same time if you divided that up.
Greg Marcus talks about the evolution of movie theaters.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with Greg Marcus from the Marcus Corporation. I'm your host, Libby Collins. I want to go back to the movie theater business because, as we said, your grandfather got started in the 30s when movies were the form of entertainment. With television, the advent of television and so much more, sort of waned, had some problems, and then Blockbuster started. How did big movies, those movies like Star Wars and Raiders and the ones that you have to see in a theater, how did that change the movie business for Marcus?
I don't know if that's really what changed the business. I think really what happened was there was a certain segment of the American population that went to the movies pre-TV. Then TV comes along. The number of people going to the movies doesn't change a whole lot after that. It bounces around. It declines a little bit. And there's a lot of reasons as to why it declines over time. But frankly, as less people are maybe coming, the prices are going up. Not insanely, but because we're talking about a pretty narrow band. And it held relatively steady for many, many, many years. But it did change in that what really changed it was the multiplex. The idea that, you know, originally we had one theater. You think about what's now with Symphony Hall, the Warner Theater. Was one theater. It was a big, giant theater. That's what the movies were. The campus theater, which we still own to this day because we're into history, one theater. But then someone said, you know, you could show two movies at the same time if you divided that up. And so, for example, they took the Warner Theater and there was a balcony and a lower section and they put a new ceiling in between the balcony and the lower section. All of a sudden, it was two screens. And so now you could show two different movies. That almost got taken to an extreme. It's eventually with 20 plexes and 24 plexes, which was too many. But this idea of being able to offer multiple movies at different times at one location, so now you only need one general manager, you only need one concession stand, maybe you needed two if it was really a large place and you need, but you could leverage an infrastructure over more movies. That did change the dynamic over time. The multiplex really was very helpful. And so when I was growing up, it was six plexes and four plexes. And as I got older, it became 14, 16, 18, 20. There'll never be another 20. Now it's probably 8 to 12 is probably what you need.
So what is the future of the movie business from your perspective?
The good thing, you know, everyone's like, oh, streaming. Well, streaming is TV. It's not going to the movies. It's not leaving. The one advantage, I'm not saying streaming doesn't impact people going to the movies. There is an impact on the margins, and our last customers are our most profitable because, you know, you got to plow the parking lot whether you have one or 100 people, so better to have 100. They are all different flavors, whether it became VHS, that was the end of the movie business, but it wasn't. DVDs, that was the end of the movie business, but it wasn't. Now, DVDs killed VHS. Streaming killed DVDs. I mean, but these are all methods of delivery into your home. And yeah, the TV is better. But if you have a 100-inch TV, I mean, that's a big one. I mean, I don't know many people have a 100-inch TV. If you have a 100-inch TV, that doesn't even compare to a 30-foot movie screen. I mean, it's a fraction of the size. And not only is it the presentation, because I don't actually think that's what's really important about the movies. What's important about the movies is leaving. getting out of your house, getting off your sofa, being amongst other human beings, having a night out, having a date night, being out with your friends. It's about enjoying something in a way that's different. I mean, if you stream it or watch it on DVD, I defy you to tell me the difference on a 60-inch screen. You couldn't tell me. You can pause both. You can stop them. You can turn them off. You can do whatever you want to do. But when you go to the theater, it's a completely different experience. It's differentiated. You can't stop it. You have to be there at a certain time. You can't decide when you want to watch it. These are all things people say, well, that's why I like to sit home and stream. Well, that's why on the margins it can impact, because you could say, well, I could just do that. But it's not the same experience. So I always say, so you're asking me, where is it going? Well, at the end of the day, if you believe, and I believe this, and I said this during the pandemic when I was the poster boy for Schadenfreude, humans want to be amongst other humans. There's so much discussion today about how one of our biggest problems in society is that people are sitting at home alone losing their minds. So this idea of getting out and being amongst other people takes on even more importance. Now, it may take a few years for psychiatrists to get together to tell us all we need to leave, but you know, it's like, there's going to be a warning label on your house, right? There's a warning label on booze. There's a warning label on leave.
Chris, the entertainment facility that people are talking about now is the Sphere, which if you talk to anybody who was there to see The Wizard of Oz, it is not just a three-dimensional experience. I mean, you are really absorbed into it. Do you see the Marcus Corporation, as they expand and grow in the next 10, 15, 20 years, that you may become involved in that kind of entertainment?
Who knows? It's different. It is about going out. It is about being amongst other people. So there's a similarity in that. It's a $1 billion investment. Now, will there be parts of it, elements of a more immersive experience that come to us? Yeah, sure. I mean, we were always looking for new things to do, and we will continually look for new things to do. And will that be where we go? Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Well, 90 years. I'm sure you're looking at 100. I mean, it's only 10 years off. What's the plan, the short-term plan over the next 10 years for Marcus?
I think we're going to just keep doing what we always do, which is looking for new opportunities, looking for new businesses, new things to do, ways to keep changing and growing our businesses that we currently have, whether it's hotels or movie theaters. But if you look, as we've been sitting here talking about, think about the history of what is the Marcus Corporation, whether it's restaurants or limited service lodging, movie theaters and what they used to look like or what movie theaters look like today, full service hotels. I mean, it's really morphed and changed over time, and I think it will continue to morph and change based upon a set of principles that my grandfather started us with. They called them Ben's Commandments, which is this idea of, I don't think I can recite all 10. I should be able to recite all 10, but I get close. But it's about the idea of maintaining a strong balance sheet. Don't put too much leverage on your balance sheet so that you can weather the storms that will inevitably come your way. That it's realizing the people are your most important asset. We talk about that all the time. When we did the St. Kate and we first opened it, and if you've been in it, it's beautiful. It's so cool. The art is spectacular in that building.
Who came up with that concept of making it an artist with residence and so much art throughout that building?
Well, I would say that was a group effort.
But it's a unique concept.
Yes and no. I mean, well, my grandfather always said Adam and Eve are the only originals. Everything is a copy. The idea of experiential hotels is something that's been going on for a while. And the idea of, and you know, this idea of when you go to a hotel, you want something local in the boutique hotel, and that's been going on. There were art hotels. Art-focused hotels. We tweaked it a little bit because we said most of them were all visually arts-focused. In fact, we went and looked at 50 art hotels around the country. Whether there's the granddaddy is one called 21C. And there were a bunch of them around the country. A few of them have gone away now. But the 21C, which was started in Louisville by the Brown-Forman Liquor family, they had a giant art collection they wanted to display. They're in lots of places. So we went and looked at them and said, okay, we wanted to add performing arts, not just visual arts. And I'm not even sure we've been as successful at making performing arts part of what we do. I mean, I had these visions like, wouldn't it be cool if somebody from one of the theaters next door came in and gave a preview of attraction to people having dinner in the restaurant in the hotel, you know, like sang a song or did something, and never got to pull that one off. Yeah, you never know. But the idea of – so the St. Kate is this beautiful thing, right? And so when we opened it, I figured that I'd read the reviews and people would write, oh, this place is so beautiful. I love it. It's such a celebration of art. It's just visually so impressive. And I'm an idiot because I should have known better. What the reviews said to then and say to this day, they take such good care of me here. They make me feel so good. This is a place where I felt welcome from the minute I got here. Now, I actually think that the art plays into that because I do have this theory about it, and I can't prove it out, that whether it's any of our hotels and any in the hospitality business does lend itself to attracting people who are in the arts because the kind of jobs and the hours and the flexibility is not, you know, allow them to, whether it's to work on their art or to work on their craft or to audition or any of those things. and it's a business of hospitality and interacting with people. And so I think that it lends itself to people. We once did a thing called the Art of Marcus, and we had people come to the Pfister with their art, and they displayed it. And we had so many artists that worked for us. It was really interesting. I mean, Peter Mortensen, who was the concierge of the Pfister forever, was a dancer in the ballet. And Brianna Greer, who's our concierge now, is a singer. I mean, we have so many artists at our hotels. So the fact that now we have a hotel that actually celebrates what they do, so that puts them in a really good mood. And I think that helps make it even more hospitable for the people who come there.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
We'll play up in blue on a weekend once in a while, on a Saturday night or something, and play till late with a bunch of people. We'll get a whole group together and have, you know, five of us will be playing. It'll be fun.
Greg Marcus talks about being an entertainer himself, playing piano.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Greg Marcus from the Marcus Corporation. They're celebrating their 90th anniversary this year. Now, is it true that you play piano at Blue?
Yeah. I play in the St. Kate every Tuesday. And I play in Blue. I play in Blue two Thursdays a month with a trio. I play with my really good friend and bass player, Jeff Hammond, at St. Kate on Tuesdays. And then I play with a different group, a drummer named Dave Bayless, who I grew up with, and a bass player named Jim Paolo. And we play on every second and fourth Thursday. And then Bill Boniface, who really got me back into music years ago, is a real estate, got one of the leading real estate guys in town. Bill will play up in Blue on a weekend once in a while, on a Saturday night or something, and play till late with a bunch of people. We'll get a whole group together and... Well, five of us will be playing. It'll be fun.
So bottom line, is being part of the Marcus Corporation a career for you, or is it a lifestyle?
Well, yes. But I would argue that it is a lifestyle in a lot of ways. But that's because it's a family business too. I mean, I always say that we are a family business in public company clothing, because we act like a public company because we are. And not only that, we do all the things that you should do as a public company. I mean, some public companies that are controlled with family control – they may skirt on the edges of – they say, well, I don't have to do all those things because we control it. But we really try to live to the letter of the law on how you behave as a public – as a responsible public company with outside investors. But we try to keep that family business ethos. So when you grow up in a family business, you sit around and you talk about it at Thanksgiving. I always joke with investors who if they're talking to us about the business, and if they're not happy about something that's going on because it's not always going perfectly, I'll say, hey, you know what? If you think that talking to you is tough – Come to Thanksgiving, where I got a lot of investors sitting around the table with me. So I think it's part of being a family business. Now, it helps that also some of the things that I'm passionate about. I mean, I went to film school. So, yeah, now part of the reason I went to film school is because I grew up in the movie business. So these are a little bit of a virtuous circle. And whether I'm playing music in the hotels, and none of these things were things I did when I came back originally. I didn't come back to the Marcus Corporation thinking, I'm going to play the piano in the hotels one day. That happened years later. I didn't come back thinking I'm going to be on the movie screens. I'd never been on a movie screen. It was actually... because, and I'm the movie guy. Everybody knows me. It's been going on for a long time. But it wasn't because I said, gee, how do I get my face up on the movie screen? Because, in fact, I'll tell people, I recently did a presentation to our theater managers, and I said, you want to know how I ended up there? I said, raise your hand in this group of hundreds of people. I said, raise your hand if you like seeing pictures of yourself. Of course, no one raises their hand because nobody likes seeing a picture of themselves. And I said, well, imagine seeing yourself at about 50 feet to 70 feet of glory. I said, trust me, it is not easy to see myself on that screen. And I didn't get into it thinking, how do I get myself on the screen? What had happened was, because we believe in supporting our community, let's go back to what we do as a company, and we talk about community support and being part of a community where we have investments. Well, I was the co-chair of the United Way campaign for Milwaukee. We'd always run a United Way campaign inside the company. And because I was active in the United Way and on the board, what happens over time? They say, if you are a CEO or a leader in the community, not just CEOs but leaders, they'll say, we'd like you to co-chair the community campaign. At that point, it's a $50 million campaign, big campaign. I'm like, okay, I'll do that. That's important. And so I'm out calling on companies, and every week I'm coming back to the United Way office and I'm getting the update. How's the campaign going? And the head of marketing one day says, and if you're talking about, you see, I like to have a good time and joke around. And she says, you always give us a PSA, a public service, a free ad on the movie screens talking about United Way. Would you ever think about going on the screen and doing it yourself? And I said, well, I've never actually been on a movie screen. I've never thought about it. Let me think about it. I'll come back to you. I thought about it a little bit. And I'd always sort of wondered about this idea of people come to the movies, still to this day, not to see me. They come because they're coming to see Wicked. They're coming to see Avatar. They're coming to see Zootopia. That's an ad right now that I just did for all of our movies that are playing. They're coming for that. They are not coming for me. They don't come because it's a Marcus Theater. They don't, you know, they don't say, they say, we want to go to the movies tonight. We don't want to go to the theater tonight. And, but we have to do it right. And in a lot of communities where we aren't, remember, you're seeing me here. You know me here. In Lincoln, Nebraska, they might not know who Greg Marcus is or what it means, what Marcus means. They just know that's their theater and it's a Marcus Theater. And it, what did that mean? If I could welcome people, I said, if I can welcome people, maybe I could change that dynamic a little bit. That would, I don't even know if it hurts. I don't know if it helps us. I don't know if it hurts us, but it doesn't, you know, but it, maybe it'll help us. Maybe it'll make us feel a little more local to people. And if I could welcome people and have a little fun doing it, I'd do it. And they said, well, if you'll ask for the money, you can do whatever you want. So I did it. And I went on the screen, and it was really just for this time of year, because that's when the campaign runs. And I started to notice people were noticing me more. It started off with my parents' friends. And they're, Greg, you look so cute on the screen. I'm like, oh, my God, you're old and blind. But okay. So I did it, and I noticed it more. And then I did it the next year again with it, because it worked for United Way. And I said, well, okay, I'll do it again. And I did it again, and I noticed more people. And then I started seeing the benefits of it, not just for our business, but, I mean, really around our business, around politically, locally, how people started feeling like we were local. I mean, and it works both ways. I'll be in a theater in Lincoln. They're like, where do you – oh, you're here. Where do you live? I'll be in the theater here in Milwaukee. They'll be like, where do you live? I mean, they're like, you're here in Milwaukee? I'm like, well, actually, I live here. Yes. Some people don't know where I live. That's all right.
Greg Marcus, congratulations on 90 years. Here's to another 90.
No, let's go. I'll go for it. I won't be here to find out about it, but someone will.
We've been talking with Greg Marcus of the Marcus Corporation. We talked about how his grandfather, Ben, began with just a single movie theater in Ripon, Wisconsin, 90 years ago. Now, if you joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Greg, go to WTMJ.com and share today's show with your friends and family. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.